Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use. Ladies, hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I am Jack Fowler. You're here to listen to the star and namesake, Victor Davis Hanson, who is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. Victor has a website, an official website. It's called The Blade of Perseus. Its web address is victorhanson.com. I'm going to tell you why later in the podcast you should be subscribing. Victor, before I go on, I do want to get this up front. Later next month, May and June, there'll be some times where Victor's away, but we've never gone on hiatus with this podcast. And we're going to pre-record some podcasts with your questions. So how do we get your questions? If you send them to me, I'm Jack Fowler, my email address is Jack, J-A-C-K-R-S-L-C, Jack, R-S-L-C, at gmail.com. Send the question that you'd like Victor to answer, and we will try to work that into one of the special podcasts that we pre-record. Anyway, I think that's a lot of info up front. Today is Good Friday. We are recording on Friday, March 29th. This particular episode will be broadcast on, I think, Thursday, April 4th. And today's episode, Victor, we're going to get your thoughts a little bit of Law and Order and a lot on Donald Trump. And we'll start with the Law and Order aspect right after these important messages.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, we're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, you know, there's never not maddening headlines of criminality in America as it runs amok. But two stories I think I'd like to get your thoughts on, and then we're going to talk about some Donald Trump and Biden political issue stories. So first story, and I'll give them both,
In 2022, and I think our listeners may remember this, two punks in Philadelphia, you know, teens, they beat to death a 73-year-old man. They beat him to death with a traffic cone. Well, a few weeks ago, a leftist activist judge in Philadelphia by the name of Barbara McDermott, she tossed the charges. One of those, a 16-year-old boy, totally tossed the charges out on him. And there was also a teen girl who committed the murder, although I don't know if I'm allowed to say it's a murder. And the judge sentenced her to 5 years with time served and then released her to a house arrest. So this is how crime is handled in Philadelphia. And then if you go up the Acela corridor a little bit to New York City, Victor, we have a spate of new sucker punching stories by young women walking around lower Manhattan, and clowns are coming up to them and just like belting them in the face, and some are recording it and walking off. So this is, seems to be a new craze. There's been a lot of sucker punching in the past in New York City, a lot of it against Jews, a lot of it against Asians, and now against women. Victor, your thoughts on law and order in America?
Yeah. I think it was called the knockout game, wasn't it? When it was against Hasidic Jews.
Yes.
And, yep. And it was reflected in the FBI crime statistics when they were, it came under the category of hate crimes. Right. But I think, and maybe you can correct me being closer to New York than I am, that they caught the person who had hit these women, didn't they?
As of today, I don't think so. I think they know who he was, some guy who had, but I think there have been more than one person doing this. So it seems like there's a spate of this happening. But there's some guy who was an ex-gubernatorial candidate.
Yeah, I thought his name was Skibogi Stora or something from Brooklyn. He was an African-American guy that had been kind of a perennial lower tier candidate, right? For office, yeah. Of local office. Yeah. And he I think he was connected to seven or eight of them. Well, so we'll see what happens. But if your Philadelphia story, you know, is applicable, it just shows you that nothing's going to happen to him. And, you know, it's like the policeman who was killed by those two career criminals that were let out again and again. And I guess there's two things that I gather from this, and I know it's anecdotal, but when you, I always try to look at not the anecdote, but the statistical profile. When you go to the FBI, it's about 2 years behind. You know what I mean? When you look at crime statistics, but there's two things that come up. And one is this weird idea of what qualifies as being liberal or humane. And for some reason, these judges think it's humane to let people out who've committed horrendous crimes on the idea, well, it's so inhumane to keep them away from society, and they've thought about it, and we're going to let them out. But there had to be, they never let them out into a situation in which they or their own are endangered by the consequences of that ideology. So what I'm getting at is what's happening is it's the same liberal philosophy of the left that says, I love teachers unions. I hate charter schools. My kids are in prep school. I want 30-cent kilowatt, raise the price of kilowatt electricity for air conditioning, but I live along the California coast where I don't even have an air conditioner in my house. And so, are the 70s, I want everybody bused, but my kids go to prep school. And I guess what I'm saying is the legal profession has become kind of a high caste, especially the judiciary. And when they make these rulings, they just assume that if they make a mistake, that that's not going to impact them. It's going to impact somebody far distant. And until they see the consequences, and I'm not advocating that there's some mechanism in which they should, but if they keep doing it and letting these people out, they're not just going to kill police officers. They're not just going to hit women in the face. They're just not going to throw people in the subway. They're going to gravitate to the suburbs, and it's going to affect people. It's happening in Los Angeles and places near or at Beverly Hills. But I think they do it, Jack. These judges do it because they're just assured that they can be cosmically, what's the word? They can be cosmically liberal.
Yeah.
And they don't have to be concretely aware of the consequences. In other words, that person they let out never shows up at their daughter's home. And right. They just assume that's never going to happen. And so that, and so they're protected. They're in a bubble. And it's kind of like the Middle Eastern students who are disrupting all of these events and breaking the law and should be expelled, but they know they won't be expelled because we're too afraid to cancel their student visas, because their worst idea in the world was that their parents or their state is paying these exorbitant tuition non-discounted fees. And if they get sent back home, they're going to be in big trouble. That's aside from the fact they love university communities. They love liberal atmosphere. They like the culture, the cappuccino bar, the rock climbing fence in the gym. They like all of that.
Right.
And they think there's no consequences, and they like to be romantic and have all of the American college students fawn over them as if they're, you know, on the barricades as revolutionaries, Che Guevara types. But if they enforce that and there's consequences to what they do, they'll stop it really quick. You saw that Vanderbilt protest this week where I think they broke through the door of the chancellor's office, and then they were told that they were going to be arrested or expelled. And one of them made up this crazy excuse that they couldn't be because her friend was in the bathroom with a tampon and needed a new tampon, and therefore you couldn't take her away because she was trying to solicit help as if this was a major crisis. And the other woman started talking in a very haughty, condescending fashion to this African-American police officer and said, if I go outside, I might be arrested. And you could see it was a capsulization of this no consequences generation. They're so entitled that right. they think they can disrupt, break the law, spout hateful speech, be racist, anti-Semitic. It doesn't matter, but they're never going to get expelled. But, you know, to quote Voltaire, as he talked about Admiral Byng and his hanging, hang an admiral, in that he says encourages the others. All you'd have to do in the modern context is take 6 or 7 students who are breaking the law, arrest right. them, and expel them from university, and then ensure that their student visas were canceled because they broke American law, and send them back to wherever they came from in the Middle East. And I guarantee you it would stop immediately. And the same thing with these random attacks. They take this suspect, they try him. If he did hit these women, they 9, 10, 20 counts of assault, sentence him if he's guilty, and then put him away for 30 years. And do this 3 or 4 times, and it would stop.
Yeah.
It'll stop. Three strikes.
Right.
You remember when National Review had their San Francisco retreats or fundraising lectures? I would go up. I think you were there a few times.
I was with, yeah.
And I would walk.
Stepping over dog do.
And at the end we did. But I'm talking about 15 years earlier. Right. I would walk over to that venue. I think it was the city chambers or somewhere. And I walked maybe almost a mile from the hotel. And I would leave there at 10:30 at night. And it was amazing. The lights were on. People were out in the street talking. The restaurants I'd go by, they were still full of people. It was completely safe. Completely. Right. And that could be restored very easily again.
That was all a result of
3-star strike you're out.
Yeah. But as you've talked about many times, and when the free fall happens, it happens damn quickly. Because I think it was 7 years ago, it was the last time I did that, and then, in San Francisco. And I'm walking over to this NR event, and then I couldn't believe what I was walking through that I had not experienced before. And I was scared. I'm not a tiny guy.
That was
what the hell's happening to this city?
It started about eight years ago when they started not to enforce three strikes. And I do fault Donald Trump. Do you remember when this first year when there was Candace Owen and Kanye West and they was following George Floyd and we were, I guess it was the third year of his administration. And there was this new idea that anybody who was locked up was unfairly incarcerated. And Trump supported just letting a lot of people out of prison, remember, and commuting their sentences. It was a big mistake.
Yeah.
And they were there for, they weren't just all nonviolent drug offenders. They really weren't. I have a little habit that every time I read about a drug offender that's busted with so many kilos of hashish or cocaine or OxyContin or fentanyl, it's always interesting to see what the circumstances are. And they're always armed. They have guns. They have a prior record, and it's very rare for a major drug dealer not to be armed or have used violence in the past.
Right.
And so deterrence is non-existent. It's the funding the police was sort of like cutting the defense budget abroad. And so suddenly and deprecating the humiliating flight from Afghanistan that birthed Ukraine, that birthed Gaza, that birthed the Chinese balloon, that birthed the threats to Taiwan, and defunding the police here and the Black Lives Matter propaganda, the Antifa propaganda, the idea that America was inherently a racist country that was waging war on African American males. The police were, when the statistics didn't prove that at all, but didn't matter, that destroyed deterrence. And the people who suffered the most, not only the people, but the people who suffered the most were from the inner city. And I think one of the reactions, it's so strange about life that the reactions are so unpredictable. If it is true, if Donald Trump can control himself and speak quietly while carrying a big stick rather than loudly with a twig, if he gets 20 to 25% of the Black vote, or 40 to 50% of the Latino vote, then the whole idea that voting is racist or IDs are racist or mail-in balloting should not have authentication to the same degree as it once was when it was called absentee balloting. And you can, when you have a lot of minority voters who are supposedly the beneficiaries of these liberal crazy ideas, that we just mail in if you don't sign the ballot, or if your name's wrong, it doesn't matter, or if you don't have an ID in person. But if they're not on board with that ideology, or if they're voting for a candidate that's not a beneficiary of that ideology, then that whole strategy starts to fall apart. And we'll see what happens. But if I were Donald Trump, I would be barnstorming the inner city and the key swing states and communities so-called of color, and I would make the argument, as you just did, let's look at the price of groceries, and what do you, just have a speech and say, okay, what's your grocery bill now? This is what it was when I was here. What's the price of gas now? This is what it was when I was here. What's the crime? This is what, and just keep making, and this is what I'm going to do for you and all of America. Just, and I think he could really find traction. Really do.
Yeah. Also, even by the way, in many communities, there won't be a grocery store nearby to have. They'll have to buy food somewhere, but they're being shut down. And we've talked in the past about these pharmacies shutting down because they've been robbed blind. I mean, the folks who live in the communities are not obtuse to what's happening around them. And it's just making that conscious decision at the ballot box to assign the blame, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the left-wing propaganda in places like Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or Atlanta or Phoenix or Las Vegas, these are all swing state, major metropolitan areas with large minority populations, that these people are racist, they're trying to deny you your right to vote, they're suppressing the vote for racial reasons. The only way we can contact that if we have a monopoly over getting third-party vote harvesting, being past masters at ballot curing, getting drop boxes everywhere, and we have to be in charge of the counting. I don't think that would work. I think a lot of people would say, "No, I'm not going to be the, you know, the Mayor Daley that you think I am. I'm not going
right.
to. I don't want your candidate." And I'm going to make sure that if you try to tamper with the balloting, I'm not suggesting they're going to do it, but if they do, I think there's going to be a lot of people, unlike 2020, who are going to get angry about it. And
well, Victor,
I said that before, that I think when I talk to people, and again, it's anecdotal, but when I say people in my community, they're 100% Mexican American. It's just uncanny how they resemble the white working class that Bill Clinton had captured, and that which for some part Barack Obama kept some of them. They started defecting during his reign, but they just disappeared as Democratic voters, and it was because they were sick and tired of that bi-coastal nasal twangy, you're going to do this, you're not going to use gas, you're going to get an electric car, we're going to have abortion on demand. You are going to have global warming. We're going to shut down the power plant. You're going to have this. We're going to have more regulations. We're going to have three genders. You're going to have all of that. They got sick of it. And I think it's happening to the same degree. I think just as the white working class got sick of MSNBC lecturing, or, you know, of all of that crazy Biden lectures that we saw with Obama earlier, I think a lot of the minority communities are saying, you know what? I don't want to listen to what Al Sharpton says. I don't want to listen to Oprah. I do not want to listen to Meghan Markle. I do not want to listen to Michelle Obama. They are privileged people. They have lives that don't even resemble mine. And they are no different than the wealthy white bicoastal elite that are out of touch with a white working class. And if that should happen, then you would see class starting to reassert itself as far more important than race, which it always is,
right,
to tell you the truth. And you would start to see what makes people hate Donald Trump the most, that he's a billionaire that is able to replace racial tribal distinctions with class solidarity. And if that happened, and he was able to, as I said, get half or 45% of the Latino vote, 20% of the black vote on shared class concerns about food prices and gas and national defense and cultural values, I think he could win the Senate, the House in a landslide. But it would require very, very adroit campaigning and very careful what you say and very selective strategies about who you pick as vice president and how you campaign. And I think he could do it.
Well, you've written a few pieces on the Trump versus Trump, and we're going to talk about them a little more later in the podcast. And I want folks to realize these are pieces Victor writes for exclusively for The Blade of Perseus. Talk more about that later. But Victor, I need to take a moment and want to take a moment for one of our sponsors. That's Field of Greens. Field of Greens is the healthiest thing you can do every day. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to help keep me healthy, and I promise you're going to love this product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you a 100% money-back guarantee. I got you 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping. So visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promotion code Victor, V-I-C-T-O-R. That's the promo code Victor at fieldofgreens.com, fieldofgreens.com. And we thank the good people from Field of Greens for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, we've got a lot more Trump and a little Biden stuff to come up. And let's start with the news from this a couple of days ago, from when we are recording. Again, we're recording on the 29th of March. New York City police officer Jonathan Diller was murdered, killed in the line of duty at a traffic stop. Some murderer shot him underneath his, below, I should say, his bulletproof vest, and he died in Queens. Donald Trump called the family. The family invited him to come to their son's and husband's wake, and he did. Meanwhile, at the same time, Joe Biden and Barack Obama and Bill Clinton were having a big a fundraising event at Radio City in New York City. It was they had a, I think you had a, if you want to get a picture with the three of these chooches, you had to drop $100,000 for that. Stephen Colbert, Stephen Colbert moderated a discussion between the three. He's such a jackass. We can talk a little more about him separately, Victor. Just want to mention that the that terrific, not charity, Tunnel to Towers, they paid off the mortgage of for the widow of Jonathan Dillard. Just think, immediate, boom, they did it. A terrific group. Anyway, Victor, your thoughts about a couple of these things. Donald Trump going, very authentic, I think, going to the wake and offset against this big political event in New York City, which in itself, there was uproar there by, I think some folks got actually into the event and were attacking Biden about Gaza and Hamas. Victor, your broader thoughts on all these things?
Well, it was kind of a bad, I mean, I'm not one to exaggerate individual days' events, but it was very iconic of what this campaign could be like. Because on the one hand, you had Donald Trump going out of his way to go to the funeral of a working class law enforcement person who all he did was try to pull over some person at a traffic violation. And the person had a long, long record, should have never been out, and killed this law officer with a young one-year-old child. And Joe Biden, who calls everybody, Jack, he calls any person who's transgendered and says he's been offended, he calls everybody. And he can't call. He won't call. It's like East Palestine. He won't go to East Palestine for months. He won't even call the officer's wife. Okay, that is bad enough because it shows you what people say about the left-wing movement in the country. They don't want to talk, A, to the white working class at all, and B, they don't, they're for funding the police, so they're embarrassed. He didn't call because he, A, he doesn't care, and B, he was afraid that he might hear something he didn't want to hear. And that's why Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden didn't go to East Palestine. Had that been anywhere else, if that had been in a very wealthy community in Martha's Vineyard, or if it had been, again, in a black community, they would have been there in 2 seconds. So that's the one thing. But then to juxtapose it at the very same time, to get Obama and Bill Clinton, and neither they didn't comment on either. And then Biden, these three lifelong liberal polls, and their whole purpose was to shake down this new Democratic Party, which is the party of the wealthy, for $25 million. I guess Queen Latifah was there, and they've got all these celebrities that raised $25 million. And so if that is what this campaign shapes up to be, and Donald Trump, did you hear what he said at the aftermath to the camera? He was he'd said once at the place of the funeral, and again on an airplane. He was at his best. He said something to the effect, "We're going to take care of this. This can't go on. This is not right. This person should have never been let out. This was a wonderful." It was really soft-spoken. It really sharpened the difference. If he can continue to do that, and it was sincere, it wasn't just opportunistic. And if the Democrats are going to allow themselves, and I don't mean that, that's the wrong term, they're naturally the party of the rich now, but they're going to remind people they're the party of the rich, that they're the Silicon Valley, Wall Street, bi-coastal, academic, well-off party, and they are going to the Sam Bankman-Frieds, the George Soroses, the Mike Bloomberg, all the big donors. That's what they rely on. And they're going to outspend and they're going to outraise the Republicans because that's where the money is. And the only chance to stop that is to be a party of law enforcement, middle class people and share their concerns. And Trump did a wonderful thing by going there, but they don't care. It's just like we talked about judges letting people out and they don't care. Believe me, if this had been a trans swimmer who was snubbed at an awards ceremony and somebody said something untoward, Joe Biden would have called he or her. He would have. And he's done it in the past, but not this. It's just something that he sees as a lose-lose situation. He saw what happened when Letitia James went into that...
The fireman event,
and they started booing her and yelling Trump, and she tried to quiet them. She had no success whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so... It's really something. Class is the theme. Class. Be the party of the middle class. Be the party of the upper middle class. Be the party of the lower middle class. Be the party of the aspiring poor. You don't have to be the Mitt Romney stereotype anymore, where they make fun of you because you didn't talk to your garbage collector outside your house, or you have an elevator, or you bought a Lincoln, all that stuff.
Right.
Don't let them do that to you. And just mingle with people. Don't just hang around with the old Republican constituencies, which are good constituencies. I'm not making fun of them. But I'm thinking that this is very radical, that never in my wildest dreams, when I grew up in a Democratic family, and as I said before, in 1980, I told my parents I could not vote for Jimmy Carter. And I voted for John Anderson. Remember him? I was an idiot.
I do.
Yeah, I was an 18-year-old stupid idiot. And
Victor, I did also.
I was 27 years old.
Yeah.
And I just said, I'm not voting Democratic anymore.
Yeah.
And I voted independent. I voted for Ross Perot, too. I hadn't made the change. I'm still a registered independent, but I've never been a registered Republican. But I vote for Republican candidates, but in those years, I've kind of wasted my vote. Rush, I talked to Rush. I used to talk to him when I was in Miami a few times, and I told him about Perot, and he turned white. He goes, Victor, what yeah. will you think? Remember how Rush hated Perot?
Oh, yeah.
I said, Rush, it wasn't like George H.W. Bush was our conservative. He says, I know, but boss Perot. And he went into that, remember that genius mimic he had of Perot's voice. It was almost uncanny, and he did that to me, and it was really funny. And I said, mea culpa. But the point is that never in my right mind did I think the old JFK, Hubert Humphrey, lunch bucket party would be the party of Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and his wife and Steve Jobs' widow, and all of those people, all the academics, all of that left Sam Bank. I mean, I never thought the Democratic Party, and it started with Bill Clinton. He was enraptured by celebrities and big money, and he really courted them. But I never thought that the Republican Party, Bob Dole, and George H.W. Bush, a little bit with George W. Bush, he appealed more to the middle class than his father did. And he started a little bit of traction with the middle classes, on cultural issues especially.
Right.
And although I know that he did things that didn't work out, but I don't have a negative view of George W. Bush. I don't. I got criticized a lot for that, but there was something about him that was earthy. You know what I mean? I know that he was entitled and all that, but he tried to reach out to people of a different class.
Did you ever engage him in anything? Did he?
Yeah, I did. He had.
You got some award from him, didn't you?
I was the National Humanities Award. Yeah, yeah. Medal. But he had a group of people that would. He said that each year or twice a year, some historians could come in. It wasn't about politics. It was just about issues. And he had a piece of paper and he wrote down, what books would you like me to read? And I'm serious. And then 6 months later, he asked you to come back and he actually read those books. And he talked about ideas and where do you think the country's going? And where it wasn't, how do we screw our enemies? Or And the rule was, if you told anybody you were going in, you didn't go back. And I went a number of times, and this is the first time I've disclosed it, but it was always, I never told a soul. A lot of people did. It was kind of bad, though, because it was a great honor to go to the White House and talk about books and history, right?
Right.
But some people really like to tell people they were in the White House. But
it's then currency,
Yeah, but then when he got very, very unpopular, some of the people that were asked tried to deny they ever went in there because it was rumored they had. Yes. And I thought that's the time to be nice to somebody when he's down.
The cock
down.
Crowed. Well, we're recording on Good Friday, the day the cock crowed for Peter.
It's always a good idea that you should avoid people at the height of their popularity and be nice to them when they're at their nadir of their popularity.
Yeah.
My mom always told me that. I mean, there was a judge who was unfairly, she was a judge, and there was a judge who was unfairly, she felt smeared in the local papers, and he was under pressure to resign. And she had something at her, they had a little condo in Fresno, and they had a little party for judges, and she made a point to have him come over and you know, lavish praise on him. And I remember somebody told her, why is he here? And she said, why shouldn't he be here? He's innocent until proven guilty. I don't think he's done anything wrong. They're out to destroy him. This is the time to show your solidarity toward him. And I think that's a good rule. But anyway, I got off track. But the Republican Party has a historic opportunity to appeal to the middle classes and to get us off this tribal chauvinism and get us unified by solidarity with the middle classes. And I think he can do it if he's careful. Trump has good instincts about that. He really does. He feels it comfortable about that. I've had so many people in New York tell me that Donald Trump was ostracized by the powers that be in New York, partly because of his class. They thought he was crude, his accent, everything, but that he had a natural affinity for policemen, fire people, construction workers.
Yeah.
And he really needs to develop that. He did. That's how he got elected in 2016.
Right.
And to the degree that COVID overwhelmed him and he wasn't able to do that, he lost. And he was outspent. But they should have something like that vote blue thing. It should be vote red. It should be a national, massive effort for small donations just to get people to donate and to middle class, working class, middle class, gas, 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 food, 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 safety, 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 border, 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 all the things that people care about.
And parents, I think.
Parents,
a few years
education,
ago when
education and parents.
Yeah. We're the party of parents, and then all of a sudden they stopped saying that day, the Republicans. And I thought that was terrific.
I can remember when I was making $6,000 a year. That was my Social Security shows at that. From 1980 to 84, I had two and then three children, a wife that could not work because she was home with the kids, an old house that was falling apart, and raisins at $600 a ton. 400, which was below the cost of production. And I went to a George H. Bush rally in Fresno. I remember it. And I went to a Michael Dukakis rally just to see them. And it was really funny because Dukakis, who was an elite, was talking about the cost of living. You know what George, he said, we got to get those capital gains tax down. That's what we got to do. We got to get the taxes down and get those capital. That all made economic sense. He's right. It would spur the economy. Yeah. But I didn't even know what a capital gains tax is. I had no capital.
Right.
Nobody in my hometown had any capital. If they were farming, they were broke. Only the wealthy people had capital. And I know that it's good for everybody to lower the capital gains. I believe that sincerely. But that's not a winning political issue to talk about, you know, investment this and capital gains that. You can do it, but that shouldn't be what you talk about. And yeah. I think Trump understands that. And he can really appeal to people if he does.
Well, before we get more thoughtful about Donald Trump, Victor, I do want to close off talking about what happened in New York City with the Biden, Obama, Clinton. And I hope you'd be in the mood to trash, despite what your mother would say, you know, be nice and God bless your mother. Let's trash Stephen Colbert, and we'll do that when we come back from these important messages.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show, recording on Good Friday, March 29th. This episode is up on Thursday, April 4th. So Stephen Colbert moderated a conversation between Biden, Obama, Clinton, and the clips I saw and the little reports I read about him. Just he's like everybody else on late night television, except for Greg Gutfeld. He is absolutely insufferable. But Victor, this was a nice little petard hoisting, I thought, because the day before in the New York Post, Piers Morgan wrote a column attacking Colbert. And this has nothing to do with Biden and the event. It has to do with Princess Kate in the UK. And a few months back or weeks back when there was talk that why was she, you know, hadn't she come out yet? And it was gossip about that maybe her husband, the prince, was having an affair, and stuff that's all blown up since when found out this poor lady's suffering from cancer. But Stephen Colbert was out on his TV show, sharing, mocking her at the time of having, he was having an affair. Ha ha ho ho ho. And then, he had to apologize, as a number of people have since the princess announced her that she has cancer. But he didn't. It's one of these non-apologies, total non-apology. Yeah, you know, we said a little something, but now let's move on. And Piers Morgan drilled him a new one in this New York Post column. I recommend folks go find it. But it's nice to see Colbert hoist on his petard, but also not unpleasant to see, I should say, not unpleasant, unpleasant to see another example of some phony celebrity's non-apology. He implied or acted like he was apologizing, but didn't. And I don't think they have to. And we've talked before. I don't think they have a sense of shame.
You know what I don't like about him, and I'll say that candidly, is this: it's the rise of snark. It's always the double entendre with these people. They look, they say something, and they kind of wink at you, or they kind of be. And that started with David Letterman. When you looked at Johnny Carson, he didn't really do that, and you did it. And when Letterman started getting popular, he would kind of be sarcastic or snarky or cynical. It just didn't, it came off as mean-spirited. And that has, and he wasn't that bad at it. But Colbert is the epitome. So is Jon Stewart. It was, you never really knew what, there was nothing any ever they could really say that was positive about anything other than their narrow partisan ideological agenda. And they were so hypocritical. And you're right about that. He's so self-critical of everybody. He's so critical and so self
sanctimonious,
absolutely sanctimonious. And yet here he is, and he really goes after a woman who was struggling with cancer, and he just feeds all these rumors, and then he can't, and he has this podium that he influences people, and he can't even apologize. And almost the same time, that's why I mentioned Jon Stewart, he was out there demagoguing Donald Trump, and he thinks that Mar-a-Lago has a $500 million market valuation, value, but it's evaluated at 17 million. So that's the real value. And then we find out that his first luxury house or condo, whatever you call it, in New York, is taxes are assessed at 1.8 million. He sells it for what, 18 million or something?
Yeah.
And
yes.
I mean, it was, and hello, John, that's what you do, don't you? You get a tax bill from what they feel is maybe not market value, and then you try to sell it for as much as you can. And guess what? The real estate market is volatile, and things go up and down, and you wanted to capitalize it. And you never said to anybody, oh, I just sold this thing for $18 million. I want to pay back property taxes because I was paying 1.8, and I should have been paying an evaluation based on an $18 million. And I have to do this because this is what I demagogue Donald Trump about doing. They never do. They're so sanctimonious. They think that, I don't know what it is about this elite left. They think they're just, everybody's moral superiors. And he's one of the worst. He really is. And he's not funny. And he has that little shtick that he didn't he play that he was Bill O'Reilly or some type of conservative. And I think he even ran for president, didn't he? He had a fake candidacy. And it's just snarko. Who wants to watch a snarko puss? I don't.
He also, you know, the few times he's been interviewed, he plays this game. Like, you know, I'm a practicing Catholic and I teach Sunday school. And I'm like, wow, I'm a practicing Catholic. I'm a freaking sinner, excuse me, a practicing Catholic sinner. But he's, oh my gosh, they broke the mold with him. Hey, Victor, I got to tell you one last thing about this. We'll leave Radio City Music Hall behind. A listener who calls himself the original VDH, because I think those are his initials of his name, but he wrote, what do the three presidents at yesterday's Democrat New York City fundraiser share in common? All three grew up dirt poor, never had a private sector job, and are all fabulously wealthy, even billionaire status. Include LBJ in that group. How do you say grifters?
Yeah, it's hard. That's a very good point. I'm just, when I listened to you, I was just trying to think who was the most egregious. The Clintons left office broke in 2001. And the next thing we knew, Bill Clinton, didn't he get a $500,000 for a speech in Putin's Moscow paid by the mayor groups that were associated with the mayor of Moscow at the same time? Hillary was, I think she was either running or she was a U.S. senator. And then he did that not out in 2001, but much later when she was Secretary of State and she was adjudicating the sale of Uranium One. Remember American uranium to Russia? And then when you look at what he was doing during the 2016, was it Vanity Fair or Atlantic? It was one of these liberal megaphones where they were very, very worried about Bill Clinton. They thought that he could hurt Hillary because he was on that Lolita Express or his version of it. And he was completely out of control. And he was flying here and here, and he was getting all this money from dubious sources. And there were supposedly girls, and
I think they ransacked Haiti also.
Yeah, they did. They did.
Through their foundation. Their foundation was the big shakedown.
And then all of a sudden we find out that they're worth a quarter quarter. She was giving corporations a list of gifts to get for home, her home warming of her new home. I remember that that came out. Which kind of crystal? Remember, these people who are socialists really do are materially acquisitive and snobbish.
They but want their DACA. Yeah.
Exactly. And it was weird that, and then you look to the second one, Obama, and he had nothing. And he was a small-time grifter. We've talked about Tony Resco in the past with that little lot expansion deal he did with that crook who was a felon, later incarcerated. And then we had that little scam where all of a sudden, remember Michelle Obama got a triple in salary when he became a senator for working for the University of Chicago hospital.
She was making over 300 grand.
She was. And the job was basically steering poor people away from the ER and the hospital. Yeah. and then coupled with her rhetoric about raising the bar and we can't make it, and they always do this to the victim thing. But then he did something very strange, and I mentioned that before. The last year when Trump and Hillary inherited the political attention, the media attention, he bowed out. And he understood a central truth that the more you didn't see him and the more you didn't like, the more you didn't hear him, the more you liked him. He was the first black president. He was, you know, he was charismatic. He looked, he was out and he did what he wanted to do, which he was, he said, not me. They asked him, what is your chief fault? He said, I'm lazy. And he went out and he just played golf the last year. And he went from about 40% up to 52-53%. And it was amazing. And he used that time to leverage his office. So suddenly he got out and it was this next, was it $50 million from Netflix? And it was just the memoir contracts. And it was just lavish. Corporate America wanted to give all of their money to this couple. And then all of a sudden, this man who had said that we've got to bring the inner city, remember, to the suburbs, and the suburbs were culpable for their apartheid. And he even had said at one point when he was a community organizer that it was perfectly okay to go to the homes of bank presidents and accuse them at home of redlining and discriminating. All of a sudden that was dropped. And he had the wherewithal in succession to buy that Calorama. Was it $8 million for that mansion in Washington's toniest environment, suburb? And then he goes out and buys this 14-acre Martha's Vineyard overlooking the coast. I thought you never were supposed to buy coastal property.
Right.
According to Obama, global warming was going to destroy it. And
indigenous Indian land also.
Yes, it was. And we, the public, shouldn't be responsible for the rich that live near the coast because we warned them about global warming. And then we learn he's got like 2,000 gallons worth of propane that he's burning. I thought, oh, that's a big false. And the thing is huge. So then I thought, well, he had a beautiful home in Chicago where Bill Ayers supposedly, allegedly wrote his memoirs. Then he's got Calorama. That's two. So why does he need three? He made fun of Joe. Remember he ran in 2008 making fun of John McCain, couldn't remember how many houses he had.
Right. Right.
That was the insinuation that John McCain was the idle rich and he was senile. But any case, that was three. So I thought, you know what? That'll be it. He's not going to do another one. And then he goes over to Hawaii and he builds this mansion and the people get very angry because it disrupts natural drainage to the beach. And he does all these environmental stuff and he builds another one right on the beach. And you want to say, Barack, for 8 years, you told us not to live on the water, that global warming was going to inundate, and we don't want to subsidize the losses of people on the beach. And now you built a big beach, and it's secluded, and you were a man of the people. And can people walk from the interior right by your house? I don't think so. You're not going to let them have access to your waterfront estate? Why not? And then, you know, it was just, you saw what he was the whole time.
Yeah.
And he was somebody who was in it for the adulation. And he, at times, he played the right race card. At times, he divided the country and by tribe. And he was He leveraged all of that, and he got where he always wanted to be, an idle, retired, multi half billionaire. And that's where he is. And yeah, you're right. He started. And then when you finish that troika on stage, good old Joe Biden from Scranton, never had a job in the private. Oh, he had a private sector job. Remember, he said he had to quit because he was moral, and he worked for an insurance company that went after a man with a damaged penis. Remember that? And we found out that that story was completely bogus. There was no record that he'd ever been on that case at all.
Oh, my gosh. I never heard that one.
Yeah, he was. He told that was in the, I read the Robert Hur report. Out of the blue, he says, you know, I was an insurance company, and there was a guy who got injured on the job, and he had a penis damage. And, you know, anytime he can talk about sex in any manifestation, in that same conversation, he's talking about how hot his wife is in a bikini to the special prosecutor. Anytime he can do that, he never misses an opportunity. But how did he end up with three really expensive homes? I don't understand it. And how did the big guy, I mean, how did that family conglomerate get $25 million? How did his brother write him a check for, was it $200,000 or $400,000? $200,000 loan repayment? And then you think, okay, you get a big check from your brother as soon as the Chinese money comes into the family coffers, and he writes at the bottom, loan repayment. So therefore, it's a loan repayment. But right, do you have any paper? Do you have any IOU? Do you have any documentation that that's not just a distribution from a foreign source? No. And can you tell us who paid? Is it true that Hunter paid for your utilities, as he attested in his emails on the laptop? So he became very wealthy, is what I'm getting at. And when Robert Hur asked, why did you take these things out when you knew in 2017 that it was unlawful to have classified files in your possession? And he said, I had two purposes. I thought they would be helpful for my political career, which is exactly what Donald Trump said, that he basically wanted these files to consult because he thought they were going to fall in the wrong hands, or they'd be used against him, or they'd be misinterpreted or abused. And people didn't believe that, but apparently they believed it was okay for Biden. And the second thing was, he had an $8 million book deal, and he thought that he needed exclusive information that would make it interesting. So he needed classified files to consult. And so here we are. You're absolutely right. There are three working class people who went into politics. They were all men of the left. They all professed that the rich were the target. Tax the rich. Joe Biden can't finish a sentence without the rich paying their fair share. And in the case of Joe Biden, of course, his son is facing massive tax noncompliance charges. And if there was any justice in the world, the IRS would be going after him for the monies he received without paying taxes on them, no doubt.
Yeah.
But they all talked a good class warfare, and they all became multimillionaire. And they all schmoothed with celebrities and Silicon Valley titan. That's who their natural constituency is. He does not want, Bill Clinton does not want to go anywhere near Arkansas. And Barack Obama does not want to go back to his Chicago neighborhood. And Joe Biden doesn't go to Scranton, believe me.
Yes. Griftio. Ergo sum. I think that's the correct Latin for this, Victor. We're gonna get your thoughts about a book you've written, The Case for Trump, which is celebrating its fifth anniversary, and there's a revision. And let's look, get your thoughts about that when we come back from these important messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, first, I just have to say one word, and that's barbecue. Just hearing it makes your mouth water, and you may already have a low temperature, slow cooking smoke or egg or pellet barbecue. But in the middle of your busy week, who has that kind of time? You folks need a Hot Fast Solaire infrared gas grill. It heats up to 1,000 degrees in just 3 minutes, even on cold winter nights. That heat locks in juices and flavor and grills food faster. In just a few minutes, your family will be sitting at the table enjoying delicious, better than restaurant quality grilled food, juicy steaks, moist chicken, tender fish, and healthy grilled veggies. Solaire is a multi-generational veteran-owned business. Their portables, carts, and built-ins are all made in the USA from commercial-grade stainless steel, so they are built to last. Get your free guide how to choose the right infrared grill at besthotgrill.com. That's besthotgrill.com. Solaire infrared gas grills for fast, delicious grilled food every day. Once more, besthotgrill.com, besthotgrill.com. And we thank the good people from Solaire for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. So, Victor, the case for Trump is was written 5 years ago in March, best-selling book. You've written a new introduction to it. I wonder how you've approached it, how you would make, I mean, obviously there's a different case to make for Donald Trump in 2024 than there was in 2019. But how have you approached this? And it's a new edition, right? Or a new?
Yes, this is a new paperback. It's going to come out in August. And I had written an update of Donald Trump from the election up to 2021, the Biden first, for the paperback edition. This is a new paperback, and I was asked to update it. But I didn't want to just do another little preface. So I wrote a pretty long, I think it's 18,000 words, a huge update for the paperback. So it has new material. And I wanted to explain two things. Number one, why I went back and looked at the polls in January, right after January 6th and on into February. That was the nadir of Donald Trump. He was polling 35% popularity. It was only his MAGA base. I don't mention all, but there were people you wouldn't imagine that were disassociating themselves from him. And that was for three reasons. One was, of course, the left said that January 6th was an insurrection, and they had fortified the Capitol with 30,000 troops. So besides the January 6th imbroglio, there was this idea that he had Linwood and he had Sidney Powell and other assorted characters that were insisting that the Dominion machines were communicating with Venezuela and China and all of that. And that brought his ratings way down. And then I think, you know, what the worst was on January 5th, the day before the Capitol protest riot, whatever you call it, that was the special election in Georgia. And no one in their right mind thought earlier that, I mean, Purdue had won the popular vote during the November election. So nobody thought that these two Republicans could ever lose in Georgia because they didn't win a majority and they were going to go up, both of them. That was very rare. I think it was the first time in Georgia history, or maybe the second, that they were both up for election. And more importantly, Jack, it determined the fate of the Senate. And if they were to win that, then after losing the House, they would be able to ram through a Biden agenda. We knew Biden was going to be president, despite the Trump effort to suggest that, you know, the election was fraudulent. So what did he do? He basically did two things. He offended the independents, and then he basically told people their vote wouldn't count. And the result was 700,000 Republicans who had voted November for Purdue didn't show up. They lost both seats, and they lost the Senate. And with the loss of the Senate, they had lost the legislature, the whole Congress, and the presidency. And people blamed Donald Trump. And so what brought him back? This is when everybody was talking about an ascendant DeSantis, who in 2022, when you had that kind of disappointing, squeaky win, he won by a million votes. And they were already mentioning him and other candidates as well. So it was the most remarkable political comeback since Richard Nixon in 1962, who said you don't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore after he lost the California governorship. And then 6 years later, he was president. So how'd he do it? I try to explain that. And it's a long story, but I think most of us realize that there were certain things that really helped him. And one was the complete collapse of the Biden administration. And by that, I mean that as soon as the Afghanistan humiliation was fully absorbed and digested, Biden never again was at 51%. And then it just got downhill with the hyperinflation, 9%, and all of that. And Trump, people took their attention away from Trump the man to Trump the record. And they started comparing inflation, crime, foreign policy, energy with Biden, and he started to creep back up. And then in addition, people started to look at January 6th a little bit differently. They overplayed their hand. Lynn Cheney and Adam Kinzer stock were the only Republicans because they were not really ever going to be elected again, and they both had voted to impeach Trump. And the committee was kind of one-sided. The stories about five policemen were false, dying. The only person who died violently probably was Ashley Babbitt, who was shot unarmed. And then we had the New York Times reporter who was caught by Operation Veritas saying that FBI informants were everywhere. Anyway, the point I'm getting at is there was more to January 6th than the boilerplate, massive violent insurrection, five people died that were law, all of that crap. And people started looking at it a different way, and they started to compare it to the May, June, July 2020 riots. And I can go on, but basically the introduction says this is where he is now. And no one in their right mind thought that at 76, he would be in this position. And the old narrative that his opponents used quite effectively for a while, we thought, DeSantis or Haley or Pence, that he can't beat Biden. He's pulling behind. He started to pull even and then ahead of Biden. And that just demolished the opposition. And then I do the second thing, and nobody in their right mind thought, A, that they would try to take him off the ballot. B, that they would try to, in that civil suit, if you read the E. Jean Carroll, people forget that is the most egregious of all of them, of all of the law problems. And I've gone through them on this podcast. And then to have Jack Smith charge him for the identical crime that Joe Biden has been exonerated for. And then the insurrection element is going to fall apart. And then Letita James with no crime, no victim, no real violation of law, $450 million. Then we get into the Fannie Willis circus, the Alvin Bragg, that no federal prosecutor wanted to pursue that so-called campaign violation of having a non-disclosure agreement with Stormy Daniels. He did. I think that's going to fall. But my point is, that too, the Biden record, the rehabilitation and reexamination of January 6th, and the sheer hysteria and lawfare and get him off, all of his opponents in the primary could not fight that. They were in the impossible situation of saying, I'm going to criticize Donald Trump because it's a natural thing for a rival to do. And people would say, okay, so you're on the side of Letita James and Alvin Bragg. And they never could square that circle. Haley couldn't dissent. And the only possible It was amazing. The only possible argument was Donald Trump is in a possible situation. I deplore what they're doing, and I am in a better situation with more ability to get Donald Trump out and make sure that he gets fairness under the law and no one else gets into his situation again. And then nobody made that argument. Yeah. And so he had this rapid rise, and I explained why it happened. And I end the introduction by saying, but I'm not going to suggest to you that he was passive and all of these things were just, he was carried along the river, so to speak, downstream. No, he changed a lot. He started to he moderated a lot of his language. And I think the best thing in this process was that he had been kicked off Twitter, and then he went and got the Truth Social. So he wasn't back on new, he was off old Twitter. He wasn't back on new Twitter. He was invited, but he didn't use it. And the result was he was not tweeting to 70 or 80 million people 6-7 times a day, you know what I mean, unfiltered. And so all of that incrementally, but in aggregate, explains why right now he's 3 to 5 points ahead in most of the 9 to 10 key, except for Michigan. Pennsylvania and Michigan are closer, but maybe Pennsylvania's dead even, but Michigan, he's got 3 or 5. And nobody thought that would be possible if we were back on January of 2021.
Well, Victor,
I hope people like it. And I also finished just quickly saying the Ajaxian tragic hero is absolutely constant in the book. I think it's been borne out that Donald Trump brought to the political arena certain skills that were absolutely valuable to get this inert, ossified country moving again, whether it was what he did with energy, what he did with foreign policy, how he redirected our attention to China, whether it was championing the industrial base, getting tough on immigration. But the only way you could do that was to have a certain set of skills that were going to offend everybody. And he did. And the people invited him. He was you and I've talked about the High Noon, the Shane, the Magnificent Seven, the Searcher's character. But as he got more successful, people started, they have a margin of error, or they could relax, or they thought things were going, and they started to focus on the tweets, i.e. his six-shooter. And they thought, not in my name. Now things are going well. I never invited this crude gunfighter in. And that's the way all tragic heroes are. They're outcast, and they have skills that can save society, but in the process of saving society, they offend it by their very success, and then they become expendable. And that happens to a lot of people, and that happened to him. But we'll see if he has a second, you know, sometimes in America, there's second chances, and we'll see.
I hope he's
learned from his earlier.
He's not going to learn from Professor Hansen. Who will he learn from? But Victor, we're almost out of time, but I just want to press on this a little more, and because you have a few ultra pieces on this. And let's do that right after this final important message. With the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, I may be asking you to do an impossible thing in like 2 or 3 minutes. Talk about, it's your show. Talk about however long you want. But you have a two-part. It's going to extend it to 3 parts, but or more. But it's titled Trump versus Trump. And you're saying the greatest threat to Donald Trump's election, a potential election in 2024, is Donald Trump. I think that's fair compacting of it. If you just briefly, like, unless you're going to repeat what you already said, what is Donald Trump's grandest threat to himself?
His grandest threat to himself is that he is poised, because of the mediocre, disastrous, not mediocre, disastrous, what will be 4 years of Joe Biden, and the mistreatment that he has suffered from this extra legal campaign to destroy him emotionally, financially, psychologically, materially, and the empathy that naturally accrues to him, and his record that was superb for 4 years, he is in a position to win the Senate, to win the House, to be reelected after this hiatus in a Grover Cleveland fashion, and to have people like the Heritage Foundation to give him 20,000 vetted names and a whole agenda so he doesn't end up with Scaramucci and Omarosa and all, and Anonymous and all that stuff. And all, and he has to worry about his health because he's 76 and what he's doing would kill you or me. And the stress he's under, he's got to take care of himself. He's lost weight. He looks good. He's sharp. This idea that he's senile, that the left is peddling, is not true when you listen to him. But there's no need to call Nikki Haley bird brain or to go after Ron DeSantis about how you destroyed him. He could even call, he's going to need Ron DeSantis. He should incorporate Ron DeSantis. He should understand that he can't run for reelection. So these people want to be in the party. They want to be on good terms with him. And even Nikki Haley will reach out to him. He's got to accept that and make sure that he can, that he does not lose that 5 to 10% of the Republican base as he did in 2020 right. to Joe Biden. He's got to give those people a reason to vote for him. And the reason he's, the reason is, look at my record. I will repeat my record again. Look at Joe Biden, what he's done to the country. Do you want to support that and subsidize that? And yes, I understand you don't like it, but it's not about me. And I'm going to try to do things that are going to reassure you that it's about my record. And so he doesn't need to get into the ad hominem cul-de-sacs.
Right.
I understand why he does it. He goes after a judge. He goes after, you know, these are crooks. It's to shake them up and let the people know that he's not going to be a patsy. But he's got to finesse them and turn their animus toward him back onto them in a boomerang right. fashion and make them look silly and small. And he can do it with humor. He's got, I don't know why he doesn't use that. And I've mentioned that before in this broadcast when his brother tragically died young and people were trying to press him. Well, why didn't you drink or do you drink? And he said, oh my God, can you imagine what I'd be like given my personality if I drank? And it was funny in a somber occasion. And he was right. And what he was saying is I have a tendency to excess and alcohol would only accentuate that. And in other words, he was self-critical. And if he can be self-critical and joke about himself and he has that ability, he's a naturally, what I guess that what's kind of tragic is he's not a vindictive person like Joe Biden is. I know that people are going to say, Victor, are you crazy? No, he does not want to. He didn't do the FBI what Obama and Biden did. He didn't do the IRS. There's no Lois Lerners. He didn't have a Comey or a McCabe. They were all out to get him. And he's not going to go weapon. He's right when he said, it was another brilliant thing he said, my revenge is success.
Yeah.
All he has to do is keep reading. I'm going to get back at the left by uniting the country. If we unite the country, there will be no hard left. There will be no squad. There will be no Bernie Sanders. They will have nothing to say to people. Because they had their chance and they failed. And I'm going to unite you around prosperity, deterrence, safety, local control, parents. And that he'll win. I know people that I didn't think would vote for him. They'll vote for him. They'll give money to him.
Yeah.
If he can just control it and not get into, hey, to a non-entity. He doesn't have to live blog the Oscars and start making fun of, you know, master of ceremony. It doesn't need, there's no upside to that.
Right. Well, I just repeat the aforementioned Trump versus Trump articles. These are pieces you, Victor, have written
for The Blade of Perseus, your website at victorhanson.com. I'd like to encourage our listeners to visit, and you'll find roughly two books worth every year of Victor writings, exclusive to that. $50 for a full year, but $5 a month. So it's discounted if you take the full year option. You'll also find links to Victor's other writings, his American Greatness essays, syndicated columns, the archives of these podcasts, his various books, including the book that's coming out in a few weeks, The End of Everything, May 7th. If you haven't ordered it, go to Amazon and do so. As for me, Jack Fowler, I write Civil Thoughts, a free weekly email newsletter. It comes out every Friday, and it has 14 recommended readings. I have a link to an article I've come across the previous week that I think is really good that you will enjoy, and I have an excerpt from the article also. Civil Thoughts is non-transactional. We're not asking for money. We are not selling your name. It's completely free. I do it for the Center for Civil Society at AMPIL, where we are intent on strengthening civil society. So if you go to civilthoughts.com, sign up, you will begin to receive it immediately. Now, Victor, if I can only find my misplaced papers, a comment that I had pulled aside to read, but you know what? I can't find it.
That's fine. I want to say just in ending, though, that I'm not critical. My point is I'm trying to suggest that these areas of strength that Donald Trump has innately and through his experience, he needs to focus on his strengths. And that is he's funny, he's charismatic, he's self-deprecatory, and what he's not good at, he doesn't have to do because he doesn't need it. And that is getting into these dead-end riffs with nobodies and just diverting his attention. And then,
right.
And I think the final thing I'll say is when I meant this is not about Donald Trump, this country is at the abyss. I know everybody says that every election, but this time it is. This can't endure another 4 years of this crazy neo-socialist Jacobin stuff. And so he represents not Donald Trump. He represents the aspirations of millions of Americans that see no way out. They don't believe there's three biological sexes. They don't believe that 10 million people from a foreign nation flooding their non-existent border is normal. They don't think smash and grab and carjacking and the knockout game is good. They don't think Afghanistan should ever be repeated. They don't think that we should pull out and sell Israel down the river and pull out our support. So he represents all of that. And he has to encapsulate that idea that it's not about me, it's that I have to be the vessel to stop this madness. And that carries an enormous responsibility, more even than 2016 or 2020. And I'm confident he can do it, but he has to be self-disciplined and be careful. Every 1% that he loses may be vital. And I'm saying this because 70% of the electorate will not vote on election day. And the error rate, again, for those ballots has diminished by a magnitude from what it used to be with absentee. And he's going to be outraised by 3.5, 4-1. And yet he can overcome all of that if he's just cognizant of who he has to win over and to reassure them. And I think he can do it. I get a lot of criticism for saying that. People say, Victor, screw you. He doesn't have to do anything. They've screwed him over. They mean exactly. But he does need people that I don't agree with on a lot of issues, but who on the vast scale of 51% conservative versus 49% non-conservative, they're 51% conservative. And I'll take them. And I want them to get out and vote. And that's what he needs. He needs them. He needs not just a narrow, he needs a landslide to send a message to stop not just the political revolution, but the cultural and social revolution.
Yeah.
If he gets 53, 54% of the vote, carries the Senate and House, he can stop this madness.
Yeah. It's got to be stopped. And your
Reagan did.
And it's to his ears if that your because your advice is
look at Reagan. He's had Jimmy Carter. No inordinate fear of communism. It was all started in some ways under Carter, and Reagan stopped it and gave you 12 years of normalcy.
Well, so, I did find a comment, and we're going to end the show now with this. Folks who go to iTunes and Apple leave comments. They rate the show 0 to 5 stars. 4.9 is the plus is the average. So thanks. You appreciate Victor's wisdom. And we also do, by the way, read the comments on Victor's website, The Blade of Perseus. But here's one comment left on iTunes Apple, and it's titled The Best. Nobody explains it better than BDH. An uber intellect that is easy to follow just finished up The Dying Citizen, a masterpiece that hits all bases. Extremely thorough and informative writing by Mr. Hansen. Thank you for being a beacon of hope, T. Thomas F.L. Victor, you beacon of hope. I appreciate all the wisdom you shared today and every day. It's a great honor to be able to engage with you in this way. Thanks for sharing all the wisdom, folks. Thanks for listening, and especially if you're new to this podcast, thank you. Hope you come back. And if you're interested in past podcasts, go to Victor's website. You'll find the archives. You can hear his brilliance 4 times a week. We will be back soon with another episode of the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Thanks very much.
Thank you again for listening, everyone.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.